This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good morning, everyone. It is Sunday, March 3rd, picking up again with the halachic process. We are still in the Shita of the Rambam, and today we're dealing with, the area of certain types of rebellious people against the halacha. This is the section called Hilchot Mamrim, the laws of the rebels, and the intent of doing, this set of halachot is that from learning what not to do, you could learn like how the halachic system works, meaning going beyond it. Meaning those who go outside the halachic system helps you define, well, what in fact is the halachic system. All right? So first, Dana, start us off with chapter 3, halacha 1.
Person who does not acknowledge the validity of the oral Torah is not the rebellious elder mentioned in the Torah. Instead, he's one of the heretics, and he should be put to death by any person. By any person?
Death by any person. Right, so read the footnote.
Oh. As the Rambam continues to explain in the following halacha, a heretic should be slain. Any person may and should take the law into his own hands in this regard. There is no need to wait for judicial process.
We're going to see the next halacha too, but first off, right, in Hilchot Teshuvah, Laws of Repentance, Rambam gives his definition as to who is a kofir, who is a denier, and who is an apikores. Here he's throwing in another idea, which he's going to explain in later halachot, of a zakein mamre, a rebellious elder. But he first makes a distinction, which is just rejecting the validity of the oral Torah doesn't make you a zakein mamre, it makes you a kofir. Dan, take number two.
Since it has become known that such a person denies the oral law, he may be pushed into a pit and may not be helped out. He is like all the rest of the heretics who say that the Torah is not divine in origin, those who inform on their fellow Jews and the apostates. All of these are not considered as members of the Jewish people. There is no need for witnesses, a warning, or judges for them to be executed. Instead, whoever kills them performs a great mitzvah and removes an obstacle from people at large. Has that been used recently in Israel?
No, because, well, I shouldn't say that. You know, this is where it gets a little bit more complicated, right, in terms of how do you apply it today. Because when you say kofir b'torah sheba'al peh, how do you define Torah sheba'al peh? How do you define what is the oral law? Meaning, if I'm going to be one sort of fundamentalist, I can say, whoever goes against the Gemara, I ought to be able to kill. Right? On the other hand, people will say, well, it's not just the Gemara, it's Torah Shebaal Peh continue today, which means if you don't listen to my gadol, then you are kofir b'Torah, Shebaal Peh, and therefore I have a right to kill you. Right? So my sense is that it's, you know, even if you want to say you're arguing with the Maimonidean system of what is Torah Shebaal Peh, you know, you can have a really big internal war within Judaism. I mean, you've got pretty major Rishonim that would argue on Rambam's position here, which, according to Shita of the Rambam, could wipe them all out. Right? No, I am not recommending that.
Moridino so velo malin?
Yep.
What about malin, the Kodesh, pain, moridino?
Well, the point is that they're not Kodesh. Right?
Yes.
Shalamas, number three.
To whom does the above apply? To a person who denies the oral law consciously according to his perception of things. He follows after his frivolous thoughts and his capricious heart and denies the oral law first, as did Tzadok and
Baitos,
and those who erred in following them. Different laws apply to the children of these errant people and their grandchildren whose parents led them astray, and they were born among these
Karaites,
and raised according to their conception. They are considered as children captured and raised by them. Such a child may not be eager to follow the path of mitzvot, for it is as if he was compelled not to. Even if later he hears that he is Jewish and sees Jews and their faith, he is still considered as one who was compelled against observance, for he was raised according to their mistaken path. This applies to those whom we mentioned who follow the erroneous current path and their ancestors. Therefore, it is appropriate to motivate them to repent and draw them to the power of the Torah with words of peace.
Okay. So here he clarifies a little bit more. What does he mean to be a kofer, to deny the Torah Shebaal Peh, to deny the Oral Law? So first is, you have to really make an intention to say, I don't care about the oral tradition. Meaningless. Right? And it's something that you do because you came to terms with this on your own. Right? Meaning you decided to study, you put in the effort or whatnot, and you say, hey, you know what? This ain't for me. And he gives the examples of Tzaddok and Baitus. And you see the footnote here. These were two of the greatest students of Antigonus of Socho. As Rambam says in his commentary to Mishnah, after they heard Antigonus teach, don't be a servant to serve their master for the sake of receiving a reward. They forsook Jewish practice, saying, is it just that we labor without receiving a reward? They began splinter sects with the intent of swaying the people after them. At first, they sought to abandon Jewish practice entirely. They said, however, that people would not accept this, and so focused their complaints on the oral law, arguing that although the written law was of divine origin, the oral law was not. Their intent, however, was to deny the entire Torah. Similarly, the individuals mentioned by the Rambam deny the oral law first, i.e., their intent is to deny the entire connection with God and the Torah. So Rambam, you could read this in a couple of ways here. You can either say that, you know, I shouldn't say that. You know, with the example based on the footnote here is that by cutting off from the Torah Shebaal Peh, it's not just a matter of, like, we believe in the authenticity of the Torah Shebichtav to the exclusion of everything else, because there's that human element of tradition involved. It's explained much better, more eloquently, in my father's teacher's book, Rabbi Jose Faur's Horizontal Society. It's a little bit of complicated nuance there. However, the distinction here primarily is between whether or not you deny it of your own knowledge versus, let's say you just weren't raised with it. And Rambam here is making a big distinction here in terms of a tinok shenishba, someone who is, you know, raised as a captive amongst, you know, people who are non-believers, in which case there's an acknowledgement that you're not really a heretic per se, but you were just
ignorant.
Not ignorant, and I would say conditioned in a certain way. Meaning, and you can argue, and this is a nice, you know, postmodern type of view of truth, of like, well, no one really knows anything, this was just how the way you were raised, and, you know, sort of an apologetic type thing. And Rambam has a certain degree of acknowledgement of that, where if you were raised in a, you know, non-observant household and you were raised to be a heretic, according to Rambam here, you're not really a heretic. As much as this was, or at least you're not the type of heretic, you may be a heretic, I shouldn't say that, you're not the type of heretic that we can just go out and kill. Yeah.
Okay. So, you see somebody in the public square saying, the Gemara is a sham, and you happen to be carrying a gun, and you shoot the person like the Rambam says. Shouldn't you ask questions first, like, excuse me, how did you come to this conclusion? Were you raised by wolves, or were you raised by...
Yeah.
Literalists or reform or something.
This is something I would not say would be good for halacha l'maase. Yeah. Anyway. So, this is one type of kofir, one type of heretic in terms of deny. And here he's also talking about, mind you, not even the specific details, but the overall authenticity of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Right? Because, you know, we... Jewish law, or at least, is not just dependent on pure biblical law. It's biblical law is interpreted through the rabbinic sages, right? Now, to say that they have no authority or there's no connection between that and the Torah sort of undoes the entire system. Meaning, to simply argue on, well, the Gemara says this or the Gemara says that, well, that's not what Rambam is talking about. So it's more of a matter of, you know, do you think that there's any... a divine origin of an oral tradition. Now, keep in mind, according to Rambam, things can change over time, right, within the oral tradition, right? There are rules of the oral tradition, and things can develop, but the source of it still has to get traced back to Moshe Rabbeinu, meaning you can still have new takanot, new decrees, that have to follow the rules of Torah Shebaal Peh, right? You can have new interpretations of biblical verses, which, according to Rambam, as we saw in the last chapter, don't require a bigger and better court. You still may need a Sanhedrin, but you don't need a Sanhedrin gadol b'chachma gadol b'minyan, bigger in bigger in number and bigger in wisdom, to come up with a new biblical interpretation. Right? See, it's not a matter so much of the details that Rambam is saying makes you a kofar, as much as a denial of the entire divine origins of the oral tradition, would be the way of putting it.
According to the last paragraph that I read, we basically have a responsibility to teach people like that.
Yes, meaning if someone was raised in, let's say, a non-observant household, like let's say, I don't know, you were, let's say there's a Karaite rabbi out there, right? And he has a kid, right? So you don't kill the kid, right? You know, don't really do much to the kid, but you try to bring him in to the best of your ability. Whole separate slew of laws there about how do you do tochacha, how do you do rebuke, how do you educate someone one step at a time there, you know, but it's a matter of, you know, just because you were raised in a certain way doesn't mean you are a kofar. And it's not, by the way, a matter, I mean, people will say, oh, you don't know enough to be a kofar. It's not a matter of how much knowledge you have, as much as what was the tradition in which you were raised. If someone was raised, let's say you've got a Ivy League college professor, they tend to be relatively intelligent and knowledgeable, right? And they have a kid, right? So they can teach the kid everything, right? But if you teach it from a very different perspective and a different mindset, kid's going to have all the knowledge. Kid might even be able to read Gemara better than your typical yeshiva bacher, right? But that doesn't mean that he had that attitude of, you know, well, what is the significance behind it? Make sense so far?
If he studied Gemara alongside Christopher Hitchens, there's a pretty good chance.
Just one minor question. Maimonides is making a historical claim about Tzedek and Vitus.
Yes.
Is there backup for that?
Sort of. We did a... Well, there's what Rambam says and what the footnote says, which is, you know, a little bit more. We, if you may remember, we did a class on Tzedek and Vitus in Politics of Exclusion way back when.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, I know. But I can't repeat the whole thing here. Anyway, here's where we get to another, you know, really good piece of, you know, juicy, difficult halacha, which is the Zakein Mamre. So according to Rambam, the rebellious elder, Zakein Mamre, mentioned in the Torah, by contrast, is one of the sages of Israel who received the tradition from previous sages and who analyzes and issues a ruling with regards to the Torah, as do all the sages of Israel. Meaning you're talking about one of the insiders here. His rebellion involves an instance when he has a difference of opinion in one of the Torah's laws with the Supreme Sanhedrin and did not accept their views, but instead issued a ruling to act in a different manner. The Torah decreed that he should be executed. He should confess his sin before being executed so that he will be granted a portion in the world to come. Even though he analyzes and they analyze, he received the tradition and they received the tradition, the Torah granted them deference, meaning the majority. Even if the court desires to forego their honor and allow him to live, they are not allowed, so that differences of opinion will not arise in Israel. There are more details here. Dana, take number 5.
A rebellious elder is not liable for execution unless he's a sage, erudite enough to issue halachic judgments, who has received smicha from the Sanhedrin, and who differs with that court with regard to a matter whose willful violation is punishable by kares, and whose inadvertent violation requires a sin offering or with regard to tefillin. He must direct others to act according to his ruling or act according to his ruling himself, and differ with the Sanhedrin while they hold session in the chamber of hewn stone.
Meaning while they're still in, you know, deliberation, like that's their home office.
When, by contrast, a student who has not attained a level of erudition that enables him to issue halachic rulings, but nevertheless issues a ruling, he's not liable. This is derived from Deuteronomy 17:8, which states, if a matter of judgment exceeds your grasp, implied is that the passage concerns only a scholar who is unable to grasp something which is exceedingly difficult to comprehend.
All right, Dan, take number 6. I know I have to run through these a bit. We're not even like running through it. We have to do a couple of laws because otherwise, I mean, the way Rambam writes is he'll say something general and then he'll like go through the details. So it makes sense to read a little bit more of the Rambam and then we can have a discussion over, you know, what we saw. So take number 6, please.
If a sage was an exceedingly great scholar and a member of a court and differed with the Supreme Sanhedrin, and he returned home and taught others according to his original conception, but did not direct them to act...
act accordingly.
Where am I? I think I'm maybe missing a page.
Oh, sorry.
Act accordingly. He is not liable. This is derived from Ibid 12, which states, and the person who acts obstinately, i.e., if the punishment is warranted, not for speaking obstinately, but for issuing a directive for action or for acting oneself.
All right, and Shalom, thing number six. Well, numbers, the second six, this should be seven, but apparently I'm not the only one who makes typos.
If he found the Supreme Sanhedrin outside their place and rebelled against their ruling, he is not liable. This is derived from states, and you shall arise and ascend to that place. Implied is that the place is the cause for capital punishment. All of the individuals mentioned above who are not executed, and anyone who acts in a similar manner, although they are not liable for execution, the Supreme Sanhedrin should place them under a ban of ostracism, separate them from the community, subject them to corporal punishment, and prevent them from teaching their interpretation of the matter.
All right, let me just do, I mean, I want to skip to 4.3, because in he elaborates on one of the requirements is it has to be a punishment of karet or higher. Danny, you were a little bit perplexed by the thing of tefillin.
Yeah.
So flip ahead a bit to 4.3. It might probably is the second to last page in the packet here, where it says, if the difference of opinion between the rebellious elder and the court will not lead to such a situation, the rebellious elder is not liable for execution unless the difference of opinion concerns tefillin. What is implied? If the rebellious elder gave a directive to add a fifth compartment of tefillin, making five compartments, he is liable. This applies provided he first made four compartments as required by law and then made a fifth and attached it to the outer compartment. For an outer compartment is not exposed to open space at all time, it is unacceptable. The obligation of a rebellious elder in such a matter is a law transmitted by the oral tradition. If, however, they deferred regarding to other mitzvah, e.g.
Differed
with regard to other mitzvot, e.g. he disputed one of the laws concerning lulav, tzitzit, or shofar, one claiming that it was unacceptable, the other claiming it was acceptable, one claiming that the person fulfilled his obligation, the other claimed he did not fulfill his obligation, or one says he is pure, he is impure 2 degrees removed, the elder is not liable for execution. Similar laws apply to analogous situations. So here, let's sum up who this Zakei Mamre is, who this rebellious elder is, all right? So, and we're going to go through in a bit the actual procedure behind it, but the details are, one, you are a sage. You're a sage who is worthy of smicha. You are part of, you know, the, as my father might say, the rabbinic fraternity. You argue, not just argue, but let's say there's a dispute over something, a mitzvah, the punishment for which, if you do it intentionally, is karet, or an otherwise a sin offering, as opposed to if you do it intentionally, your punishment would be, let's say, makot, lashes. That in the hierarchy of things, let's say someone eats something that isn't kosher biblically, your punishment is lashes. But if, say, you don't keep taharat mishpacha, punishment there is karet. Right, and karet is considered more severe. So it has to be anything about karet or higher. On top of karet is death. Right, pretty big deal there. Also, he has to actually go out and teach it or do it himself. If he does not teach it, meaning he keeps it to himself, as a matter of prescriptive halacha, meaning there's a distinction between saying, here's what the Sanhedrin thinks and here's what I think, which is descriptive, and telling someone else, you, this is what you ought to be doing, right? Or, you know, showing it yourself. And also, the Sanhedrin would still have to be in court at the time. Now, granted, doing the other stuff, you're not really doing something good either. But in terms of being liable for death, the Zakei Mamre, this rebellious elder, is not denying the system of Torah Sheba'al Peh, as much, you know, in the sense of like it comes from Shemayim. He's denying, what is he denying?
the reliability of the Sanhedrin.
The reliability of the Sanhedrin. I mean, the Bible ultimately says, "Acharei rabim lahatot." You're supposed to instruct or, you know, side with the majority. When you deny the authority of the Sanhedrin in this way, right, you can say that, oh, I'm just arguing with a bunch of men who are sitting in a room. But you aren't, since, you know, it's one of the things that we saw with the origins, with the basis for rabbinic authority, is some divine sanction behind it. You're also, in fact, arguing with God, right? The Sanhedrin paskins one way, and you are instructing other people to paskin against it. Right? Any thoughts on this so far? Okay, let me make things a little bit more complicated. This was the subject of a very controversial article in the YU Smicha's journal Beit Yitzchak about this rebellious elder. Because let's say you're in a situation where you really think everyone else in the Sanhedrin got it wrong. And yet you want to go out and tell other people what to do, right? So you're not trying, you know, to rebel against the court. You are principled. Now, according to Rambam, or at least the way he describes it, and based on the Gemara, if the Sanhedrin makes a mistake, 70-1, and they paskin incorrectly, who brings the korban? The Sanhedrin. But if the Sanhedrin rules 70-1, meaning even one person dissents, and Sanhedrin made a mistake, who brings the korban? Everyone who followed them.
I think you just said the same thing twice. Mm. Did you?
No. Yeah. If it's unanimous.
You said
71. Sorry. Right. If it's 71-0, thank you. Right. If it's 71-0, right, a unanimous decision by the Sanhedrin, then the Sanhedrin brings the korban if they make a mistake. If it's 70-1, or anything less than unanimous, anyone who follows the Sanhedrin brings a korban for making a mistake, which puts the Zakein Mamre in a very weird position. Because on one hand, if he follows the majority and he knows that they're wrong, well then he has to bring a korban because he should have known better. On the other hand, if he actually acted in according to his own psak halacha against his 70 colleagues, according to Rambam, you put him to death. Somewhat of a catch-22, don't you think? Stymied. Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Yeah.
You put him to death even though the Sanhedrin has to bring a korban.
Apparently.
So who's right and who's wrong?
That's a wonderful question. Who is right and who is wrong? Or maybe does that necessarily matter? Think about that for a second. Let me go back to 3:8 in the Rambam. Here's where he describes the proceedings. How is the law applying to a rebellious elder adjudicated? When a matter is undecided because of its difficulty, and a sage who is erudite enough to issue rulings, whether regard to a matter which he arrived at his own reasoning, or which he received from his teachers, he and the sages who hold differ with him, and ascend to Jerusalem and come to the court, which holds sessions at the entrance to the Temple Mount. All right? The court tells him, this is the law. If the elder listens and accepts the ruling, it is desirable. If not, they all go to the court which holds sessions at the entrance to the Temple Courtyard, and they also say, this is the law. If the elder listens and accepts the ruling, they go their ways. If not, they go to the supreme Sanhedrin of hewn stone, from which the Torah emanates to the entire Jewish people, as Deuteronomy says, from the place which God has chosen. The supreme tells him, this is the law, and they depart. If the elder returns to his city and continues to interpret the law as he did previously and teaches this interpretation to others, he is not liable. If he gave a directive for action or acted in according to his conception himself, he is liable for execution. There is no need for a warning. Even if he offers a rationale to explain his conduct, we do not heed him. Instead, once witnesses come and testify that he acted according to his own directive, or that he directed others to perform a deed, we sentence him to death in his local court. We take hold of him and bring him from that place to Jerusalem, for we do not execute him in the presence of his local court, nor in the presence of the Supreme Sanhedrin who left Jerusalem, but instead bring him to the Supreme Sanhedrin in Jerusalem until the next pilgrimage festival, he is kept under watch. Death row.
During the pilgrimage festival, he is executed by strangulation, as implied. All Israel shall hear and become fearful. This indicates that his execution must be announced. There are four transgressors whose execution must be announced publicly. A rebellious elder, a lying witness, a person who entices others to worship idols, and a wayward rebellious son. For with regard, all of them, the Torah says, so they will hear and become afraid. All right?
So here, I mean, the way that Rambam describes it is that the rebellious elder isn't necessarily part of the Sanhedrin himself. He's more of like your local Rav. And the local Rav who goes up and he, you know, keeps on appealing his case to the highest court, and he still doesn't want to listen to the highest court. And yet he gets put to death for this. Right? Not only is he put to death for this, but he's put to death for this because you want to make everyone else afraid. One second. There is a significant difference here between a random person who doesn't follow the Sanhedrin and a Rav who's reached the point of smicha, who teaches people to go against the Sanhedrin. One is a much bigger threat to society. One is a whole lot more subversive to a halachic society than the other. It's one reason, I think, why you would find Rav Moshe Feinstein, for one example, who, even though he was quasi-tolerant of conservative Jews, had nothing but disdain for conservative rabbis. Right? Because today, once you have a title rabbi, and you start saying things with, like, you know, printing editorials, writing stuff, and the word rabbi is in front of your name, that lends to it a certain degree of authenticity. And saying, well, wait, this rabbi is saying something, therefore it's okay. And then it breaks down whatever system that you're trying to set up, either way. Right? No matter what type of rabbi you are in this world today, there's someone else with the title rabbi who will be saying things that completely contradicts your entire concept of what Judaism ought to be. Meaning, if you are a liberal rabbi, there are going to be rabbis who are more conservative, who will say things that you find appalling, and vice versa. Right? It's a much greater threat than if a random person does. Here, you have someone who's reached that level and is, according to Rambam's description, holding enough of a position of authority. If you're in that position of authority in a local town, what you're effectively doing is not just posking for yourself, but you're turning the whole town against the Sanhedrin. That fosters rebellion, hence the name Zakein Mamre. Right? Now, if you want to say who's right, well, the question is, what's the goal? Now, I can say that better, you know, if the Sanhedrin Haggadol says something, right, better to follow the system and deal with the consequences later than to try uprooting the entire system altogether. But it's important to realize here that the Zakein Mamre isn't someone who disagrees with another colleague. You have to be disagreeing against the actual Sanhedrin. So it doesn't apply to today where, you know, oh, I don't listen to that Guttel, I'm therefore a Zakein Mamre. No. I could say in a localized community, right, you may be able to apply some rationale. Where if you have a Rav of a shul who paskins, this is the halacha in the shul. Someone else gets up and he says, you're wrong, I'm going to paskin differently, and I'm going to tell other people in the shul to paskin against the rabbi. Now, today you don't have a system of chayrim, but you could argue that that's more of a rebellious type of thing. Right? And a rabbi might not be so wrong. I mean, I don't know any rabbi who has this authority, but can expel someone from that congregation. I mean, again, it rarely happens that way. But that's what really causes dissent in a community. If someone in a shul instructs someone else not to listen to the rabbi of the shul, it's a pretty big deal. Not Zakein Mamre bad, because that's, you know, a matter of execution. Huge difference between the Sanhedrin Haggadol and any rabbi, individual rabbi, who is not the Sanhedrin Haggadol. Right? Very important distinction there. Yeah.
So Elu for Elu only applies to members of the Sanhedrin?
No. It's a matter of halachic process. They could, there's, I mean, I use the term halachic truth. The Zakein Mamre could have a valid argument, but it is halachically wrong to follow him. Not unlike following Shammai over Hillel when the halacha is not like that. You had Rabbi Tarfon, right? Let's give the example here. So Elu ve'Elu appears two places in Gemara. One is in Gittin regarding an Agadata, about two different ways of reading, two ways of reading a particular verse in Navi with no halachic implications. And the other one is between the dispute between Hillel and Shammai. But given that Elu Ve'elu applies to Hillel and Shammai, Rabbi Tarfon, who was strict to follow Beit Shammai over Beit Hillel, and that he lied down on the street for Kriyat Shema, so that he could say it B'shachvecha while he's lying, according to the Gemara, was Chayv Mita for going against the words of the sages. Right? So you can say Beit Shammai had a legitimate read. It was a plausible read. That doesn't mean that you could follow him. I mean, there's a matter of halachic truth. Just because someone said so, just because there's a rationale for it, doesn't mean that you have the right or the authority to follow it once a decree has been made. There are rules about how halacha can evolve, how halacha can change, which opinions are worthy and which opinions are not. Like in the discussion over why does the Gemara include minority opinions, or the Mishnah include minority opinions of halacha, is not like that, because a later Beis Din can, you know, overturn it and say, well, you know what, now we're going to follow Rabbi Yehuda over the Chachamim. That doesn't mean myself as an individual am allowed to follow Rabbi Yehuda over the Chachamim. Right? A huge, huge distinction there. But thank you for bringing that up. Right? And once the Sanhedrin decide that this is halacha, to quote, oh, I'm blanking on the guy's name, but paraphrase from a former U.S. Attorney General, they're not final because they're right. They're right because they're final. Right? They determine what the halacha is, and then that's what a psak is. The word psak, there's an element of finality. Here's what it is, until, I mean, it gets revisited down the line.
The infallibility of the Sanhedrin.
But it's, again, it's not really the infallibility, because there are things that they can do are incorrect, but they're the ones that will actually make the decision there. I mean, that's why you have the korban that the Sanhedrin can bring. Meaning, the Sanhedrin has the right to determine this is what psak halacha is, but there are rules which even the Sanhedrin is obligated to follow. And the fact that the Gemara acknowledges that the Sanhedrin is not itself infallible is huge. It's a Gemara at the beginning of Horayot, right? Because as much as the rabbis might have assumed a certain degree of authority, they never said, well, you know, whatever we say goes and that's it, right? Disagreements can happen, and you can still argue with the Sanhedrin. No one is telling the Zakein Mamre not to teach things differently, and no one's telling the Zakein Mamre that he can't, let's say, lobby or try to influence or try to convince people down the line. What the Zakein Mamre is not allowed to do is tell people to break the law. Here would be the difference. Let's say I take a case before the Supreme Court, right? And I get voted down. The Supreme Court makes, in U.S. law, the Supreme Court decides against my case, right? Now, I can still disagree with it. I can still bring cases to the court. What I'm not allowed to do is tell other people, ignore the Supreme Court's ruling, right? Here's a good example. Dr. Death, Jack Kevorkian, right? Doctor-assisted suicide. So let's say I take it all the way up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court rules doctor-assisted suicide is illegal, right? And it's murder, whatever, or whatever under the purview of the Supreme Court to decide for that. Yes, I know it's a legislative type act, but let's say, you know, they determine that the laws declaring it let me rephrase this to be a little more accurate. Let's say some state or federal law says doctor-assisted suicide is considered murder. I think that's unconstitutional. I take it up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court laughs at me and he says, no, this is a constitutional law. Law on the book stands. It would be the equivalent of me going back to wherever I'm from and saying, oh, sure, go ahead. Doctor-assisted suicide is unconstitutional. Go ahead and do it. Even though the Supreme Court just said that it wasn't upheld the law. That's where the rebellious side comes in, and that's what you wouldn't be allowed to do. Right? That doesn't mean you're not allowed to still think it's unconstitutional. It doesn't mean you can't bring additional cases to the court. But as long as that is the established law of the land, you're not allowed to go ahead and teach that it's not. All right? Make the distinction clear?
Yeah, I just think that's what infallibility of the Pope means. Not that he can never make a mistake, but what he says goes.
Ah, so that's an interesting way of infallibility. I always took infallibility to mean they are, in fact, right. But the difference there is important. As far as I understand with the Catholic Church, the Pope speaks in the name of God, whereas in the Sanhedrin, the very fact the Sanhedrin could, in fact, make a mistake means that they are, whatchamacallit, means that there is that level of, you know, human error there, and that they are not speaking as the language of the Ramban was. It's not, or Tertullian, depending on how far back you go. It's not that the Spirit of God is speaking through them and they're acting almost like prophets, right? It's a matter of, we are going to argue, we're going to do the best that we can. Mistakes can be made. But when you realize, and you know, there's certain rules about mistakes, which Rambam talks about in Hilchot Sanhedrin, about how can, in fact, Sanhedrin make a mistake, which takes it out of that realm of infallibility. But until, you know, that gets demonstrated, you have to do what they say. Which is also a very important point regarding, you know, what we as the masses do. Like, there's a joke people say, I think I probably use it here too, if a rabbi gets up and says something, and you do it just because your rabbi says so, v'salachta la'avoni ki ravhu, God will forgive my sin because, I mean, it's a pasuk in Tehillim. We say a modified version of it with slichot. V'salachta la'avoneinu ki ravhu. It's like, forgive our sins because they are many. But that's a way of saying, forgive my sin because the guy's a rabbi. Right? And it's a fascinating halacha in that even though what you are doing might make rational sense, you are still accountable for your actions. Here's a practical example. We deal with a lot of questions about kashrut, especially private hechsherim or smaller companies. Meaning a private hechsher is that the one individual rabbi's name is stamped on it, and other smaller companies, you've got numerous around in New York. One friend of mine actually found a problem with one of them. One of them tends to give hashkachot to vegan and vegetarian restaurants, which are pretty easy to do. And a friend of mine found a cook cooking a dish using non-kosher wine. Now you think, like, vegan, like, how hard is it to screw up a vegan restaurant?
Right.
That's the way. Like, unless you're, like, talking about Shemitah and Shemitah and Masra, the only way to screw up vegan food is if you're cooking in non-kosher wine. Right? Now, ordinarily, the guy's reliable. So here's the question. Right? You're lying on a particular hechsher that he's saying that this food is kosher. And you've got a lot of hechsherim out there that people call sketchy hechsher, right? And they may cut certain halachic corners that you may or may not know. You'll pass by a particular restaurant, and I'm intentionally not mentioning any names here, and you can say, well, gee, it's under this rabbi certification. There's stuff in the window that says this place is kosher. Why not? I'm going to go in there and eat. Did you do anything wrong? Rabbi says it's fine. Right? Tough call there. If you follow straight Shulchan Aruch, you're probably not eating proper food at certain establishments with hechsherim. Right? But the question is, you know, would you necessarily be held liable for that or not? If you say, and it can, you can wind up with other, you know, questions down the line, which is, if you say no, well then now I have to start questioning all rabbis. Right? And that you can't just blindly trust rabbis, you can only blindly trust some rabbis. Or a question that I asked that really annoyed certain people came up regarding Eruvin, which we're going to be starting this week already in Daf Yomi. Yay! Most Eruvin that exist today in the world are not kosher according to the Gemara. And there are a whole bunch of, it's a huge long topic. Why do people use Eruvin? Because with a lot of discussions over Rishonim and Achronim over time, certain things became, quote, accepted as being, quote, acceptable, right? So, you know, most people today use Eruvin for two reasons. One, their rabbi says it's okay. And two, the community does it, right? You put those two things together, fine. By that same token, I tend to ask, well, what if I'm a conservative Jew and I want to drive to shul on Shabbos? My rabbis say it's okay. My community does it. If those are going to be your criteria for halachic observance, right, for determining what is okay and what isn't okay in Judaism, well, then what's really the difference?
Seems to me Rav Moshe would answer, because they're not really rabbis.
And how would you prove that?
Ask him, I don't know.
Right. Well, Rav Moshe, for all the stuff that we saw in the Rav Moshe, and everyone who's listening, look back to the Politics of Exclusion series. I don't know where Rav Moshe gave a systematic argument as to why conservative Jews were so bad, but I could, you know, and he just made a lot of statements. And we saw from Saul Lieberman in the Orthodox, maybe the hiring of Mordechai Kaplan, but I can also argue this. Why, whatever deviations that conservative Judaism made why would they be different than any other deviations that came up over the course of Judaism? Meaning, why is it okay for one group of Jews to go against the Gemara, but it's not okay for another group of Jews to go against the Gemara? That gets a bit tricky.
Who was it okay for?
Oh, that we're going to start seeing in a couple of weeks. Yeah. All right. Have a wonderful, wonderful week.